fourth and fifth graders coming with us for part of the worship, as they've done so far this morning. But now at this point, we dismiss the third through fifth graders for a discipleship class. So those boys and girls and their leaders can step out now. And while they are doing that, I would invite the rest of you to turn in your Bibles to the book of Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 5. As you can see from the top of your outline that we have given you in the bulletin, that this is the fifth sermon in this series from Ephesians 5. We're studying the whole book of Ephesians, but we have slowed down a bit here in Ephesians 5 as we have looked at matters concerning the home, and in recent weeks in particular, instructions to husbands and to wives. Now, I know for men and women alike that when we are looking at passages of Scripture that address us specifically about what God calls us to do, that it's at times uncomfortable, that the Word of God at times cuts us deeply, convicts us, encourages us, gives us direction. And can you imagine what it's like, men, if you're sitting there listening to these messages and looking at these verses and thinking about God's call upon your life? Think if you had to be the one standing up here and giving the instruction and seeking to give attention to these things, all the while knowing that my wife is sitting in the congregation. Like any pastor, I like the encouraging words that one gets for one's sermons. I learned a lot from that. That helped me, and I appreciate those kinds of compliments. And right after the service last Sunday, sitting at the lunch table, my wife complimented me on the message because, if you recall, I had shared in a moment of transparency that in going through a marriage workbook back in the fall, I filled in the blanks to the questions, I frustrate my wife when I disappoint my wife when I anger my wife when I, and I shared with you the answers I had filled in, and my wife immediately told me I was right on all three of those. You know, some of you men love to really take things apart, especially if something's broken around the house and the dishwasher's broken. You want to get out the tools and lay on the kitchen floor and you want to disassemble that thing and you want to see how it works. Some of you, even if it's not broken, want to disassemble it just to see how it works. I don't identify with that when it comes to mechanical things around the house. I've found that by the time I've spent 5 hours trying to fix it myself, I probably just would have been just as quick to go ahead and call the plumber, whoever is more trained, and have them come and repair it. But I'll tell you, there's an area where I really do like to dig in, and that is when it comes to the Scriptures, and especially in passages such as the one that's before us. I want to know what kind of man God wants me to be. I want to understand all the working parts. I want to understand every principle, every key text. I want to understand what the words mean. And perhaps a little more than usual today, men, I'm going to be defining a lot of the words that are used in the passages that we're going to look at. I have benefited as much as anyone from the wonderful selection of Christian books that have been written and continue to be written on marriage, husbands and wives, and raising children. And all of those books, many of those books are very helpful and encouraging, and have been a great aid to me in my own journey as a husband and as a father. But I would always want to call myself back, even as I would call you back, to the fact that regardless of what all of the Christian writers may say, the place that we've got to start first for the fundamental principles concerning marriage is here in the Word of God. And that's why I have slowed down a bit, and beginning with verses 22 through 33, this is our fifth sermon looking at what the blueprint is for husbands and wives and the instructions as they are given to us. Now, beginning in verse 22, we saw verses 22 through 24, instructions for the wives, and it reads this way: Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. We saw in weeks past that just in those three verses that the Lord says to the wives that they are called to submission. And that the reason for a wife's submissive response to her husband in verse 23 is because of his God-assigned headship in the marriage relationship. And then in verse 24, he gives the model to the ladies for submission, which is the very relationship of how the church relates to Jesus Christ. Then beginning in verse 25, we find the instructions to the husbands. In verse 25, actually all of these verses, 25 through 33, Paul unpacks for us what it means to love our wives as Christ loved the church, because that is our model. Even as it was given to the wives, he continues with that same model for the husbands. And in verse 25, we see that our love is to be a sacrificial love when he says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her." Verses 26 and 27. "That he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless." We saw there that our love was to be a sanctifying love. To summarize the remarks we made about that a couple of weeks ago, gentlemen, we can ask ourselves this simple question. Is our wife more like Christ because she married me? Or is she more like Christ in spite of me? We go on, verses 28 to 30, to see that our love is to be a caring love. "So husbands also ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body." So we have shared some things about that sacrificial love, that sanctifying love, that caring love. And now we come this morning to verses 31 through 33. "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each individual among you also love his own wife, even as himself, and let the wife see to it that she respect her husband." The principle that I have given to verses 31 through 33 is that in addition to being a sacrificial and a sanctifying and a caring love, is that husbands are called to have a uniting love toward their wives. I say uniting love because our love should continually be building unity and strengthening oneness with our wives. As you can see, because of the capital letters in verse 31 in most English translations, that tips us off that a quote is being given to us from the Old Testament. And of course, it's Genesis chapter 2, verse 24 that's being quoted. It's quoted at almost all weddings, at least any wedding that takes place in a church, where when Eve is brought to Adam and we see Adam's response to the wonder of God's gift to him of a kindred spirit, of a soulmate, of someone to be his helpmeet, that the text goes on to say in Genesis 2:24, the very words that we find here in verse 31 of Ephesians 5. I read from the New American Standard, which says, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife." It's probably unfortunate that they use that translation because that's not so familiar to our modern ears. Certainly the New International Version, which many of you use, helps us to get the sense of it when it says, "shall be united to his wife." Another way of translating that expression in the Greek language would be to say that he leaves his father and mother to become joined to his wife. But the word cleave, that was the word that they used in olden days to translate a word from the Greek language, the word kala. And the word kala was simply glue. But kala does not appear in Ephesians 5:31. It's actually a different form of the word. It's proskala or proskalao. That's a more intensive form of the word. It means primarily to glue or cement together, to join firmly together. So you see, men, what that brings to mind, that if we are to cleave to our wives, that is, we are to be becoming glued to them, joined to them, cemented together. This human need and desire for this kind of union with a spouse is so strong that the text says, for this cause, that is, for the cause of becoming one flesh with one spouse, a man will even leave his parents. It could be just as well translated, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and become united to his wife. I said I was going to give a little bit more detailed information than maybe I typically do about the meaning of words. It's because I want us to not have any doubt in our minds, brothers, what it is that God's calling us to do. And he says here in the passage that we're to leave father and mother. There's one word for leave, lepo, which means simply, as I've said it, to leave, but that's not the word he uses here. He uses the word katelepo, again an intensified form. It means not just to leave, but to leave behind, even to forsake. Unity in a marriage is nurtured when there is the proper severance of the child-parent relationship, and that new union becomes a first priority. A man leaving his father and mother and becoming united to his wife does not mean that he then abandons the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother. As the New Testament tells us, the first commandment given with a promise that our days may be long on the earth. But we need to understand that in this principle of severance, a change does take place. We never cease to honor our mother and father, but something does fundamentally and dramatically change when a man leaves his parents and becomes joined to his wife. They have formed a new union, and a new household has been established in the sight of God. There is many an exasperated wife due to the meddlesome, domineering mother-in-law or father-in-law. Husbands need to take leadership in lovingly and respectfully laying out the parameters and how we relate to our parents. Why? Because this union is so sacred and so powerful between a husband and a wife that a man even leaves his parents in order to participate in this union. And if a husband's love for his wife is to be a uniting love, he needs to keep that in mind. This oneness is indeed a oneness of mind and heart and purpose, but it is completed in the physical sexual union. Thus, the impetus of the words, the two shall become one flesh. How is it that that happens? Through the sexual union. It's this conjugal union, the highest expression of sharing and intimacy, that completes the cementing of these two lives together. Thus, as I've said, the text says, we become one flesh. And that's why, even back in verse 28, men, we ultimately love ourselves if we love our wives. Why? Because we are one body with her. So our love is a uniting love when we understand the principle of severance, of the leaving and cleaving and becoming one with our wives. But the unity is also strengthened by a husband's fidelity, by his faithfulness to his wife and to her alone. Now again, this is often a verse, verse 31, that is quoted in many marriage ceremonies, as it pertains to the vow we make to be committed only unto her so long as we both shall live. Over in 1 Timothy chapter 3, we won't turn there, but I think many of you are familiar with it, we find there a list of the character qualities that must be true of someone who would serve as an elder or a deacon in the local church. And one of the things that is stated is that the man must be the husband of one wife. Now, I realize there's some controversy about how we apply that in all of its extended ways, but I would like to tell you what the literal translation of that is that he's literally a one-woman man. And that is to be a one-woman man, not only in actions that we're remaining faithful to fidelity in our actions, but also in our thought life. And speaking as a man to men, I would remind us, brothers, that we need to be putting safeguards into our own lives so that we are faithful to be diligent to maintain the fidelity of being committed to our wives and to only our wives in thought and action. So we must be careful that we don't develop inappropriate friendships with other women. I have women who are good friends of mine, but there are very clear lines in my mind about what is appropriate and not appropriate. If you're wondering what might help you along this way, if you find yourself finding some kind of emotional fulfillment or satisfaction or affirmation from a woman other than your wife, then you're on dangerous ground. It certainly means that there is no place for flirtatious actions. We must be guarded in our physical touch of other women, how we greet them, how we might embrace them or hug them. We certainly have to be careful to avoid compromising situations. And I must admit that one of the most frustrating things for me as a pastor who counsels people in marriage situations is how either naive or at least very unwise some men are in this regard about compromising situations. I remember sitting with a man some years ago in a restaurant not far from campus and talking with him. And the reason I was meeting with him was because his wife had come to me troubled because of his habit of having lunch with women in his place of work. Not a group of people, just him and one other woman on some occasions. And as I sat and talked with him and was urging him and exhorting him to cease from doing that, he didn't really take me seriously. I remember some weeks later having to be in that same restaurant again and seeing him cross the street with just one woman and my thinking to myself, that is dangerous. And many of us went through the heartbreak of seeing that man divorce his wife. To exercise a love that is promoting unity, a man must maintain fidelity to his wife because they are one flesh. I would like to take Paul's thoughts here and add one other apostle's thought to it, and it's just in one verse. And I'm thinking of the Apostle Peter. Hold your place in Ephesians chapter 5 and turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 3. There's just one verse, men, but I'll tell you, it packs a wallop. I've spent almost 30 years trying to be obedient to and live out 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. You husbands, likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life so that your prayers may not be hindered. Continuing in the thought established by Paul in Ephesians 5 that our love is to be a uniting love, I would like to offer three more observations from Peter's text here about how we can be creating this oneness and unity with our wives. And the first thing I would draw to your attention is the fact that Peter says, you husbands, live with your wives. Now, don't be too quick to assume that you know what that's all about. For me to say to you, husbands, live with your wives, you could readily say, well, our mail comes to the same address. We eat at the same table. We share the same room of the house called the master bedroom. We share the same bathroom. I have been faithful to her in fidelity. But is that fulfilling the requirement of living with one's wife? Again, and I spent a lot of time in looking at the lexicons this week and reminding myself from the Greek dictionaries of what these words mean that we use. Listen, I'm going to read right from the lexicon what the word live means. It's the word synoikountes. Several definitions are given, but you translate it through the grid of how it is at your house. To live with means being closely aligned with. To be completely at home with. To share with someone. It also means close companionship. And a final rendering, perhaps my favorite, an in-depth dwelling together. An in-depth dwelling together. Now, as I read those four or five shades of meaning to this word, synoikountes, I think we could readily see, men, that there is a vast difference between living together and existing together at the same address. I would expound on Peter's comment here about living with our wives to suggest that living with one's wife involves participating in and contributing to the groundwork of domestic harmony. Unfortunately, many husbands abrogate any responsibilities for the running of the home and raising of the children to their wives and don't really share with them in these things. I believe that is a neglect of a loving husband's duty if he totally dumps everything onto his wife to take care of at home and that he's only going to give attention to his career. I mentioned 1 Timothy 3 a moment ago, talking about the character qualifications for elders and deacons. Another one of the ones that is mentioned in that list is that he must be one who manages his own household well. Now, to manage one's household does not mean to be bossing everybody around, but it does mean this. It means to preside over and to lead. Literally, the word means to stand before. And I liked Vine's dictionary of Greek words when it says it means to attend to, indicating care and diligence. So managing one's household means that you're being diligent and giving care and sharing with your wife in what is involved physically and emotionally in running a household. Now, the degree of tangible immediate involvement is not the same for every couple. And we need to understand that. It varies depending on your stage of life. These things change. But men, I believe what we are called to when we are called to manage our households and to live with our wives is to at least be investing energy and thought into what is going on and to be communicating with her and interacting with her about how things are going in the home. And now having two sons that are young men, and I'm not dealing with some things that we did years ago when they were younger, stages of life do change. When we were in seminary, I did all the laundry. I washed all the clothes all of the time for almost 3 years. And the reason I did that is Priscilla worked at the bank full time, every day, 8:30 to 5. I was in class, worked part time on campus, but I tended to have more discretionary time at my disposal. And so it just made sense to me that I should be the one to do the laundry. That seemed to be the fair thing to do. When we graduated from seminary and I came back and started the ministry and we started to have children, I was away from the home a lot more, and Priscilla was not working, then she was home, and then she started doing most of the laundry, at least for the family. You guys are going to love me for this. I've always felt that there's no reason why I shouldn't do my own laundry, so I've always done my own laundry. And when Jonathan and Joel got to be high school age, I insisted they learn to do their own. I mean, why should the wife be responsible for just doing everybody's laundry? I mean, we all know how to work a washing machine, or we can learn. Now, it doesn't mean if someone gets behind that as a favor and to be courteous, we don't try to do each other's laundry once in a while, but I think you get the point of what I'm trying to make here. It's just simply unfair for the husband to fail to live with his wife and give attention to the responsibilities of the home just simply because he doesn't find it fulfilling or pleasurable. And it's easy for the man to be lured away and to be totally oblivious to the home by becoming totally absorbed in his hours at the office, or to keep his nose buried in the newspaper or his favorite hobby journal, or to be taking his nap or tinkering in the garage. I believe that if we're loving our wives and living with them as we should, that we should be, as I said, and I repeat myself, participating in and contributing to the groundwork of domestic harmony. Something else about this one verse. Live with your wives in an understanding way. Now again, I want to go to the Greek text here because it's helpful. I think some translations say live with your wives considerately. Literally, what he says is live with your wives kata gnosin, according to knowledge. That's what he says. Live with our wives according to knowledge. The New American Standard renders it, live with your wife in an understanding way. Before I explain that a little further, I know several of you, because I saw your names on it, got this email that was sent around. But it tells the story of a man walking along a California beach, deep in prayer, and he's glancing out to the left there from that California beach. And all of a sudden he said out loud, Lord, grant me one desire. Suddenly the sky clouded above his head, and in a booming voice, the Lord said, because you have tried to be faithful to me in all ways, I will grant you one desire. And the man said, build a bridge to Hawaii so I can drive over anytime I want. The Lord said, your request is very materialistic. Think of the logistics of that kind of undertaking. The supports required to reach the bottom of the Pacific. The concrete and steel it would take. I can do it, but it's hard for me to justify your desire for worldly things. Take a little more time and think of another desire that you think would honor and glorify me. The man thought about it for a long time and finally he said, Lord, my wife says that I'm uncaring and insensitive. I wish that I could understand women. I want to know how she feels inside, what she's thinking. She gives me the silent treatment, why she cries, what she means when she says nothing. How can I make a woman truly happy? And after a few minutes, God said, you want two lanes or four on that bridge? We can't get out of here with a laugh about it. We must ask ourselves the question, if it says literally, live with our wives according to knowledge, we must answer the question, according to a knowledge of what? And I believe the context is clear. It's according to a knowledge of her, which is why most translations opt for understanding way or in a considerate way. Jay Adams, who is a Christian counselor and author, made this comment. He said, the old cliche, you'll never understand a woman, must be squelched. Husbands need to be told, as indeed Peter tells them, there is one woman you must understand, your woman, God commands it. And so we have to seek to understand our wives, to have a knowledge of her deepest cares, her fears, her disappointments, her thoughts, her expectations, her dreams. It is that intimate knowledge of her that no one else is to share, and that we are to endeavor to nurture and to achieve. Now, for the sake of time, I can't go into mentioning a lot of the specific things that I think that will help us to gain this kind of understanding, but one that has to be mentioned. We cannot address these things without taking note of it. And that is, men, there has to be a willingness to communicate. And I don't mean by wanting to be heard, but I mean being more preoccupied with hearing. And I understand that for many men it's difficult when we are perhaps badgered all day long in our places of work. I'm not. But for many, it's grueling. Sometimes relating, interacting with people can be emotionally draining and exhausting. And for many men, it's not atypical for them to come home and feel all communicated out, to feel that the well has run dry. But we can't give in to that. We must not give in to that. We've got to do whatever is necessary to set aside the time away from the children and to make sure that time does not get crowded out, to sit with our wives eyeball to eyeball and listen to what is on their heart, what it is that's troubling them or pleasing them, and to interact with them. I think I quoted Dr. Ed Wheat last week. I think it was on the outline I gave you. He's a physician who's done quite a bit of writing about marriage. And I took this paragraph out of one of his books. How does a man go about understanding his wife? First, by wanting to understand her so much, he will give himself over to the adventure of knowing her. Second, by making a careful and loving study of her. Then he tells about one young husband that he had met that described how he spent time noticing everything about his bride, even the rhythm of her breathing. He discovered that when she was angry, she began cleaning out closets and drawers. That when she was troubled, she stared out of the windows. He knew what it meant when she looked down and did not meet his eyes. He came to understand what it signified when she turned her face against his shoulder. He observed her blushes, her passing moods, and her changing expressions. She came to realize that when he asked her, "What are you thinking?" he really wanted to know. Because he longed to know her as deeply as possible, this young man literally dwelt with her in knowledge. Now, men, if this has not been your practice, and you try to take this message to heart, and you're going to go home and instigate a situation where you can sit with your wife and really hear her out, be prepared to catch her. She may faint. Also be prepared that she might not readily respond because it's just been too long since you've really done that. It's like the one husband who said to his wife when he came in the door at 5 o'clock and had been home for a while, "Ever since I got home, you've been in a bad mood. Let's forget the last 2 hours. I'll go out and come in again and we can start over." His wife said, "Fine with me." So he went out the door, came back in and said, "Honey, I'm home." She said, "Just where have you been? It's after 7 o'clock. So understand if they don't readily warm to the idea if there's been a long period. Dale Rye passed that along to me. Thank you, Dale. But there has to be a willingness to care and to be involved, to try and be sympathetic and empathize with what it is that she deals with day in and day out. Guys, you're in a dream world if you think you're just going to kind of come in the door and set down your briefcase and everything's just going to be humming without a hitch, that the dinner's going to be on the table and the children are going to be all bathed and shiny and ready to have a quality time with Dad. And if your wife just seems a little out of sorts or even downright grouchy, maybe you need to remember that it's an exhausting task to spend all day with preschoolers day after day. It's been 18 years, but I remember changing diapers, doing the same chores over and over again. The relentlessness of it all. Motherhood is one of the most relentless tasks that there is. An important and a noble task, but relentless nonetheless. Back when Priscilla and I were raising our children, a lot of the Christian writers at that time used to refer to that period of time between 5 o'clock and 7:30 as the valley of the shadow of death. It's almost like, let's drive mom to the edge of insanity. There's something about the end of the day when you're trying to get the dinner ready and the kids and you're trying to get everything settled that they seem to become more unglued than ever, don't they? Unless kids have changed in 20 years, but I don't think they have. So living with one's wife in an understanding way, I believe, would entail making sure that your wife has a break. Do you give her a day to herself and take care of the children, or a night out? Or make sure that, as it's mentioned in our bulletin today, there's a woman's retreat. You men ought to do everything in your power to make sure your wife can get there if it's her heart's desire to go. I believe every wife should be encouraged to pursue outside interests, and the husband needs to stand ready to do what he can to aid her in that. I used to joke back when Priscilla was raising our boys when they were preschoolers that, I mean, for her, even if she went to the Oaks Mall and just stared in a stunned stupor, it was a break, you know. I wonder, when is the last time, those of you with young children, your wife was able to actually get dressed, put on her makeup by herself, to not having someone pulling at her leg or calling her for something? This word that I mentioned a moment ago about dwelling together, this in-depth dwelling, do you know some of the old ancient translations would not use that word, because in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, this dwelling together in depth was actually the word they used for sexual intercourse, was to be that intimate. And so they opted to use another word in the Greek text. The final thing that I'll say here from this 1 Peter 3:7 is that we are called to honor our wives. Husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life. The word honor, where we get our name Timothy, means to value, to respect. It is proper recognition given because of one's position. And the New American Standard said, grant her honor. That means to assign or to apportion or to give honor. And we honor our wives by expressing to them our appreciation, thanking them for making our lives what they are, expressing gratitude for the little things that they do to make our lives more pleasant, whether it's scurrying the children off so that we can nap, or preparing our special meal, or the way she exercises hospitality and has guests into the home. And we honor our wives by not making fun of them and cracking jokes at her expense in front of others. Chances are, men, I got to warn you, you crack a joke about your wife in my presence that does anything but build her up, and I'll probably pull you aside and say something to you. You know the kind of thing, guests come for dinner and your wife says it's ready, and you get up and say, well, let's see what the burnt offering is tonight. One thing about 1 Peter 3:7 that haunts every husband, and it corrects a very serious misunderstanding. If you are a man who is married and you're in here today, and you know your relationship is not where it should be, and loving your wife in a sacrificial way, in a sanctifying way, in a caring way, in a way that promotes oneness and unity, and you know that's not happening, and yet you're going to Bible study, and you're praying, and you're thinking that you and the Lord are okay, you are seriously deceived. Because the text tells us here that we are to do these things so that your prayers may not be hindered. I don't have to restate it, do I? I.e., your prayers are hindered if you're not living with your wife in the ways that are described here. So, you guys, if some of you are frustrated, if you feel discontent, you're somewhat dissatisfied, if life has gone stale for you, if you just seem to be troubled and down, maybe the first place you ought to look is, how are you treating your wife? And I also love this verse. This is a powerful verse. I'm just talking about one verse here. This is a powerful verse because it also corrects something that I tried to make sure we didn't make the mistake of 4 weeks ago. And that is, it helps to guard against a distorted view of submission. Remember, we said a wife's role as being submissive is not because she is of less worth or value in God's sight. And that's clear by Peter's remark because he says, grant her honor, value her, because she is a fellow heir of the grace of life. I am grieved, like you are, to hear that the divorce rate in our culture has spilled over into the church, where the church now, the Christian church, is now posting statistics that equal the society as far as the number of divorces that are taking place. And from my vantage point, I believe that much of the reason for the breakup of marriages is because of men who have abrogated their responsibilities, as we are seeing them here spelled out for us by Peter and, of course, by Paul in Ephesians 5. Abandoning our God-given roles and responsibilities, whether it's through ignorance or forgetfulness, through distraction, through misplaced priorities, or maybe even from plain old-fashioned laziness, because it takes effort and it takes work. Looking back at Ephesians 5, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. We are to be loving our wives so that oneness is being built and nurtured. And then he returns to the model of Christ and the church, and he says in verse 32, this mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church, that there is something that I don't even know if we can completely grasp, that this incredible, intimate oneness that exists between a husband and wife is a picture of the kind of intimate communion that God shares with His people. And he began this paragraph, this section, by hitting on the principles of submission and love, and he concludes the chapter hitting on the principles of respect and love. And I think we need to be careful, because your margin probably says fear her husband, but it means fear in the sense of a reverence and a respect, a justified respect. So what do you do with this? If you feel like you're failing miserably, what do you do with this? I think you go through an outline like this, you go through a passage like this, point by point, and you just think, you know, what am I going to do this week to start to work on these things one by one? That you have to act on. Now, I realize you might take issue with some of the application that I give, and that's okay. But what you can't take issue with is the principle. And I hope you see the difference between when we're stating the biblical principle, when I give examples or illustrations to flesh it out a little bit. Because I realize we're different, and not every marriage looks the same. But the principles should be the same. For men loving their wives sacrificially, caringly, in a uniting way, and in a sanctifying way. Don't think because I'm in the ministry full time, or Steve, Greg, or Ernie, that just because this is our business all the time, that it's any easier for us. In some ways, it's harder. At our men's retreat, one of the men mentioned that sometimes he can get so irritated with his wife that he might go days or weeks and not even talk to her that much. I can't get away with that because Sunday's coming. You know, I can't stand up here and claim to ask the Lord to use me and bless me and have a spirit work through me in teaching the Word if I am harboring things with my wife. And it can't go on for weeks. Things would start to unravel quickly. In fact, maybe one advantage we have, Steve and Ernie, is the fact that by being in the ministry as a paid vocation, it keeps our feet to the fire. That's why it disturbed me when I was given this letter that was printed in a magazine. And even though it's about somebody in ministry, I believe it applies to marriages across the board. And I want you just to listen to it. My purpose in reading it is to be an impetus that if some of you men have not gotten off the dime and have not taken the initiative, that hearing this would help to push you farther toward doing something. This woman writes, "My husband," sorry Ernie, but you're the one that gave this to me a few months ago. "My husband is a full-time youth director.
He is extremely dedicated and spends 50 and 70 hours a week with young people. I think the reason he's so successful is because he's available to them, always ready to help them when they need him. That may be why the attendance has more than doubled in the past year. He really knows how to talk their language. This past year, he would be out 2 and 3 nights a week talking with kids until midnight. He's always taking them to camps and ski trips and overnight campouts. If he isn't with kids, he's thinking about them and preparing for his next encounter with them. And if he has any time left after that, he's speaking or attending a conference where he shares with others what God is doing through him. When it comes to youth work, my husband has always given 100%. I guess that's why I left him. There isn't much left after 100%. Frankly, I just couldn't compete with God. I say that because my husband always had a way of reminding me that his is God's work, and he must minister where and when God called him. Young people today desperately need help, and God has called him to help them. When a young person needed him, he had to respond or he would be letting God and the young person down. When I did ask my husband to spend some time with the kids or me, it was always tentative. And if I became pushy about it, I was nagging, trying to get him out of God's work, behaving selfishly, or I was revealing a spiritual problem. Honestly, I've never wanted anything but God's will for my husband. But I never could get him to consider that maybe his family was part of that will. It didn't matter how many discussions we had about his schedule. He would always end with, "Okay, I'll get out of the ministry if that's what you want." Of course, I didn't want that, so we would continue as always until another discussion. You threaten to leave without meaning it until you keep the threat. You consider all the unpleasant consequences until they don't seem unpleasant anymore. You decide that nothing could be more unpleasant than being alone, feeling worthless. You finally make up your mind that you are a person with real worth as an individual. I wanted to be more than a housekeeper, diaper changer, and sex partner. I wanted to be free from the deep bitterness and guilt that slowly ate at my spiritual sanity. And deep inside, there was something making me not only dislike my husband, but everything he did or touched. His "I love you" became meaningless to me because he didn't act like it. His gifts were evidence to me of his guilt because he didn't spend more time with me. His sexual advances were met with a frigidity that frustrated both of us and deepened the gap between us. All I wanted was to feel as though he really wanted to be with me. But no matter how hard he tried, I always felt like I was keeping him from something. He had a way of making me feel guilty because I had forced him to spend his valuable time with the kids and myself. Just once, I wish he would have canceled something for us instead of canceling us. You don't have to believe this, but I really loved him and his ministry once. I never wanted him to work an 8-to-5 job, nor did I expect him to come home every night. I tried to believe every promise he made me, honestly hoping things would change, but they never did. All of a sudden, I woke up one day and realized that I had become a terribly bitter person. I not only resented my husband and his work, but I was beginning to despise myself. I don't think he really believed I'd leave him. I guess I never really believed I'd leave him either, but I did. Now that's a tragic letter. And even though it addresses someone who's been in ministry, I think the principles are the same. That men, we are called to love our wives as Christ loved the church. As we were saying just before the service, Bill, the bar is set very high when you talk about that being our ultimate model. But the fact is, we are called to seek to do that. In my experience as a husband, as a pastor, I would have to say, when I think of all of the problems of marriage, and there are many that the women bring to the table as well, but when I think of all of the problems of marriage, I think the single biggest obstacle to healthy marriages in the church is the passivity of men. It is men not taking the initiative and the responsibility spiritually, physically, emotionally, to lead their families. If we are going to be obedient to the Word, we cannot continue in that passivity. My desire is not to make 200 men feel guilty today. My desire is that by looking at this passage, that even as I am looking for ways to renew my own commitment as a husband, that you would be spurred on to do the same thing. God has not called us to do something that we're not able to do, because He enables us. We have to lay ourselves on the line and from the heart have a willingness to take the initiative, to sit with our wives and say, talk to me. Where can I do a better job? Where am I failing? And yes, there may be conversations where she will ask you the same thing and you can express where you feel that she is disappointing you. I don't know of a marriage that's problem-free, including my own. But I do know this, that Jesus Christ at the center of a person's life makes all the difference in the world. And when you have a man and a woman who are committed to following Jesus Christ, the potential is there to have the kind of life that is described here. I don't think God's playing games with us. See if you can try and jump over this when it's impossible to do it. We will not do it perfectly, but we will certainly enjoy a large measure of the kind of unity and love and respect that God has said should be true of marriage. I'd like us to bow our heads. We began with silent prayer. I would like